argument now in the case of United States against Richards.
We're losing our audience.
Mr. Brindley, we'll take a little moment till it quiets down in here.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'm confident that these people are not leaving because they have read the briefs in the next case.
I hope not, Judge.
All right, Mr. Brindley, let's give it a go.
May it please the Court. My name is Bo Brindley, and I represent defendant appellant Theodore Richards. Mr. Richards was convicted at trial following the admission of prior bad act evidence that was admitted over the objection of the defense. The central question of the trial was whether Mr. Richards knew that a backpack that had been placed in the trunk, which there was no evidence he had ever seen opened, contained cocaine, or whether he believed, as he testified, that the bag contained money, as it occurred on prior instances, one of which we presented evidence regarding at the trial from a law enforcement officer.
So this case mystifies me in a number of ways, one of which is that somehow or another it seems to have unfolded that if he says it's actually just this phenomenal amount of money, this is an exculpatory fact. Usually there's an aiding and abetting idea or a conspiracy idea.
That's the thing, Judge. In this case, they didn't charge us with conspiracy. They didn't charge us with any aiding and abetting crime. So it was sufficient for us to go before the court and have Mr. Richards explain what he had done for them before, and even to call a witness to show that before he was caught in the car with secret bags of money.
I'm a regular courier of money. Yeah,
right. And not only that, but he was very forthright in admitting that he believed it was from various illegal activities, including drug trafficking and some other things that he had observed when on this ranch where he met with the people that ultimately hired him to do this.
And the interesting other thing about this is he does not go the route of trying to deny that he knew there was something in the trunk.
No.
He admits he knows this bag is in the trunk. So we have him driving up to this house, the stash house or whatever it is, and backing into the garage, right, the way the other vehicle had just done, staying a minute or two, not very long, right?
He was not in the garage for very long.
And then leaving.
Yes. There was some dispute about whether he drove in forward or backed in. The district court didn't make a finding on that. He said he went in forward. Law enforcement officer said he went in backward, and there was some dispute about them not mentioning that in the reports. But, yes, factually that's accurate. Okay. He was not in there for very long.
And he was an accidental benefit, shall we say, of the government's.
Yes. He was not being investigated, Your Honor. They didn't know anything about him. He wasn't part of what they were trying to catch. They were trying to catch this person, Juan Regalado, and people he was associated with, who they had seen before, who had been at the house before and then gone before Mr. Richards came there, and they viewed those individuals, and they were investigating them. Mr. Richards happened upon the scene after the fact, at a time when they did not actually have reason to believe there was going to be another drug transaction, which the officer admitted at the trial. The issue that I'd like to address first is the 404B issue, these prior bad acts. And in all of the briefing regarding Rule 404B that's been done, and in the argument before the district court, the government here in this case was never able to answer the central question that this court said must be asked in Miller to determine whether you actually have evidence that's being admitted for a non-propensity purpose. Even if there is an issue that's at stake, that's on the list in 404B, such as knowledge, The question must be asked, how? How does the prior bad act evidence advance proof of whether he knew the contents of this specific bag, that there's no evidence he ever opened, that's present in the trunk? How does it do that? How does it advance it? That's the question that was discussed in the concurrence in the Jones case. That's the question that Miller says must be asked. And the government's answer, the only answer they've ever given, because they didn't give one in their briefs, they gave it to the jury, and they said, he's a drug dealer, over and over again, because he's a drug dealer, he's guilty of knowing what's in that bag. And that is, Your Honor's propensity argument at its worst.
He never makes the argument, you know, I thought it was rock salt or
no, that, anything like those that. Those are a different kind of cases that this court has had where somebody might be claiming, well, I didn't know that was crack. And then it turns out they dealt with crack before. In those cases, the prior bad act does provide insight, and it can help on knowledge or intent. Here, he's not doing that. There is nothing about these prior calls in California that provides insight into whether or not in a completely unrelated set of circumstances where he's admittedly a courier for a bag that there's no evidence he ever opened, that he knows what's in there. That's why the only argument the government could make was he's a drug dealer. And they didn't just make that argument. They made it in the worst way. At one point, they said, well, they were trying to catch him out in California, but they couldn't.
Why is that not relevant? Forget about Rule 404 for a moment.
Sure.
And assume that somebody is caught in a car with a trunk full of cigarettes not bearing tax stamps.
Okay.
Right? And in the tax evasion prosecution, the prosecutor puts into evidence the fact that he owns a tobacco shop. Right? And it says, what we want you, the jury, to infer is that a man in the tobacco business knows his own inventory. He can't claim, it's less plausible for him to claim, I had no idea what was in the trunk. Right? You would think that was relevant. That seems to be the prosecutor's argument here, too, that a man in a particular line of business knows his own inventory, and it's less plausible when he says, I was totally surprised by what was in the trunk.
I think the specific facts of this case make that argument unworkable here, because here he had testified the reasons why he believed it was money and put on corroborating evidence. The prior act evidence...
The nature of the defense doesn't make evidence less relevant. It may counteract that evidence, right? In my tobacconist case, the tobacconist in defense might give reasons for thinking there was something other than untaxed cigarettes in the trunk.
But he might say, I carry two things in my store, tobacco and liquor.
Yeah, evidence is relevant when it makes something more likely. You've already agreed with me that in the tobacconist case, that's relevant evidence. And my question is why it should matter if the business is illegal rather than legal. It seems the principle of relevance is the same.
I think the reason that it matters here is even if it would bear some sort of relevance, the prejudicial impact is going to substantially outweigh
any
probative value.
That's a Rule 403 argument, not a Rule 404 argument.
It's the fourth
prong. Did you make a Rule 403 argument in the district court?
Did. And it's also the fourth prong of the Rule 404B analysis is the Rule 4...
I don't know anything about prongs of analysis. Rule 404B does not have in it a duplicate of Rule 403.
No, Your Honor. The Rule 404B, the test that this court has enunciated repeatedly, has that fourth prong...
There aren't any prongs in Rule 404B.
Your Honor, I agree with you. I'm only talking about the test.
It doesn't help analysis to transpose Rule 403 into some prong of some other rule. If you want to make a Rule 403 argument, fine. I didn't see it in your brief.
Your Honor, we made the argument that it was more prejudicial than it was probative as part of our 404 analysis when going through the test that this court set out.
So well, in your defense, this court has said that quite a few times. Whether we ought to be embroidering the rule like that is another question,
yes.
But we certainly have
and we were,
done so.
We
and
were
we
trying to follow the logic that this court has used. And the problem here is, Your Honor, what the argument that they were making, that is the propensity argument. The only relevance this has, just as was the case in Miller, is if you make the argument and say, well, once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer. Their argument wasn't that far from saying that outright. And I think it's important to think back to the Hicks case where the government said in opening statement almost the exact same thing, and this court said that's how we know that it wasn't really a non-propensity reason for admitting this evidence, because they told us. When you ask the question that this court said must be asked in Miller, and I think in the concurrence in Jones indicated this as well, Basically, what you're asking is, how is the evidence, the prior evidence, supposed to work in the mind of the jury to advance the issue that you're talking about, whether it's intent or knowledge? How is that supposed to work? And in this case, there's no way to come up with that other than to do what the government did and say, well, he's a drug dealer, so he must have known. He's a drug dealer before, he's a drug dealer now. And that doesn't work in a case where we have specific facts about a bag there's no evidence he looked in and no reason to connect what happened before in these other calls to that. The government.
Well, I mean, critical to your case is what I started with, which is this is the one in a million drug case that I've seen where it actually matters whether there were drugs inside the bag or money, because every drug deal has two sides of the transaction. Drugs are exchanged, money, or sometimes something else, but often money is given back. And in his case, it happens to help him, I suppose, that it's money. So just
yes,
because he's a drug dealer doesn't necessarily mean there were drugs in that bag.
No, and I don't think that he was a drug dealer really advances that cause other than to make the impermissible argument, once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer. Or to say, as the government did here, they were trying to catch him and they didn't, but luckily we've got him now, and sort of asking the jury to punish him for what he did before when there's no relationship. That's the argument you're not supposed to be making. And they made it. Explicitly, I think. There's no significant similarities between these offenses. The government admitted when in front of Judge Shader, when my colleague Mr. Jones made the argument, the government knows from the wiretaps that no one involved in California is involved in this incident. The government agreed with that. So they couldn't make any kind of argument of that sort that's been an issue in other cases.
Pallones are brothers, is that right? The two Pallones?
There were multiple people named Pallone in this case. The guy in California was Bell Pallones, and they weren't for bald in Spanish. There's lots of Pallones in your drug conspiracies. The guy in California went by the name of Beltran and was also called Pallone by some people. The government admitted to Judge Shader it wasn't the same guy. Mr. Jones said they know very well because they've heard the wiretaps that we've heard. It can't be the same guy. And the government admits, no, it's not. We're not saying that. And they tell the jury that it's not related. So the only argument they're making is the impermissible argument. I'd like to turn for a moment, if there are no other questions on that issue, to the issue of suppression, where we cite the Bowman cases being analogous to ours. And the only response the government made to our allegation that Bowman and Ingrell are basically analogous to ours was to say, well, in this case, we had evidence that there was going to be another drug transaction because an undercover officer had said that there appeared that there might be more drugs. The problem is they're sort of relying on this collective knowledge doctrine. The problem is they didn't present any evidence to show that there were actually articulable facts showing that there were any other drugs. They never called the undercover officer, and in the Williams case...
So you think it's a failure of proof? I mean, because if there was a clear statement, you know, that there were 20 kilos sitting in the garage and the first people took 10 of them away and now another car pulls up, that looks pretty good to me.
I think that would be a very different case, and I think that's more like the Williams case. In Williams, they had calls and they knew there was going to be another transaction. They knew that a black guy was going to show up, according to what they said. So in Williams, we had a different case. Here, they didn't know that. And the only facts that they relied on is a statement from the officer that he heard from his sergeant that the undercover officer said there may be more drugs. But they have to, according to the collective knowledge doctrine that this court has announced in Williams, they had to present articulable facts to show that idea was supported in order to get collective knowledge. They didn't do that. They could have called the undercover officer. They could have called the sergeant. They did none of those things. And because of that, this case remains completely analogous to Bowman. This is an individual who went to the house. It was a house where they knew there was drug activity going on, but they had no evidence that he was going to be there. They had no evidence that his vehicle or the truck that he followed up there were either involved in the drug trafficking incident, because all of the people from the drug trafficking incident were gone. This was a person they had no reason to believe didn't come to that house often or was visiting someone who he was following to the house.
For all they knew, he was picking up glasses that he forgot there.
Exactly right. And he pulled into the garage, and that didn't give them reasonable suspicion to stop him any more than it did reasonable suspicion to stop the defendant in Bowman. And if there are no further questions, Your Honors, I reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Pallette.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Shoba Pillay on behalf of the United States. With respect to the 404B evidence offered in this case, I think the critical distinction that needs to be made is that the evidence that the government had presented in its case in chief was circumstantial evidence that the defendant knew what was in that bag. It was the evidence of the pattern and the sort of clandestine steps he took to pick up the bag. It's the fact that he flew in from another state. It's the fact that when asked about the car, the defendant not once but four times said, "That car's not mine." All of these things, all of these pieces of evidence, showed a chain of inferences to prove that the defendant knew it was in the bag.
I thought it was an extraordinarily weak inference, only because, as I said, I mean, the government's charging decisions mystify me in this case, but once we get to drugs, we have no idea, even if you've been in the drug business for the last 30 years, whether what's in the bag is drugs or money or guns or, you know, stuffing. It could be anything. And I don't know why, because he spends time as a drug dealer out someplace in California maybe, why that tells us that the bag is stuffed with drugs.
Because in this case, the defendant's not saying he also is a drug dealer. He's very specific. Well, I work as a money courier for a cartel. I only move money. When actually asked about these calls, he said,
"And the government misspoke at one point in the argument, because there was that Michigan event, and the government tries to make that about drugs, too, when it was another rather significant load of money."
Certainly, Your Honor, and frankly, that was a legitimate misstatement by the prosecutor. But in regardless of the fact
that... And that just goes to show, you know, there... 404B is a rule that keeps out some inferences that people ordinarily make. And, of course, obviously, as you know, in some of the sex crimes area, we've lifted that restriction. We are allowed to make the propensity inference. But we've decided, the collective, have decided not to do that. So I think you need to get over the fact that, maybe common sense tells you once he's a drug dealer doing other things, maybe he knows it's actually drugs, not money, or maybe he knows what's in the bag. We can't take that you did it before, you're doing it now.
And frankly, Your Honor, that's not what the government was doing. What we were doing was that he, by saying that I thought that was money because I'm a money courier, he's essentially embracing a lot of that circumstantial knowledge evidence. He's saying, I was doing a clandestine trip because I'm a money courier for an illegal organization, a drug cartel. So to rebut that specific and narrow defense, the government proves within days of this transaction, he's talking about in detail his knowledge and involvement in kilogram quantities
of
cocaine.
But why does that mean every trip is about drugs? What if every other trip is about drugs? I just cannot see the logic here. It's as though with Judge Easterbrook's tobacco store, you know, somebody has half and half. It's half tobacco, it's half, liquor, and you just don't know which load has which.
And I think that would certainly be true for a defendant that said, I am involved in drugs and money. This defendant was very clear. And in fact, on cross-examination, when the prosecutor asked him about these calls and asked him, were you talking about drugs? I don't know. When asked, were you talking about the quantity and quality of cocaine? He says, no, definitely not. So upon being asked about cocaine, not involved in that. And then on redirect, and it's also in cross-examination, it was very clear. I had conversations about marijuana. I use marijuana. That's the drug. The inference there is the only drug I'm involved in and the only drug that I have any relationship with is marijuana. These
That's
calls
so far
rebut
afield
that.
From this case. It's just...
These calls specifically rebut that, though, because within days, in other words, he's an active drug dealer within days of that conduct. We know that from the calls. So it's more likely that he knew that he possessed the drugs he actually possessed as opposed to being
right,
a state.
Right, because he did it before.
Not because he did it before.
Yeah. No, because he did it before. Yeah.
Frankly, Your Honor, the district court was very specific in addressing this. He said that the jury and the court are not required to put blinders on. The defendant has now testified to this story. I am a money courier. And that is why this evidence, these four phone calls with the district court was very clear and limiting after a rigorous voir dire of the DEA agent twice, after limiting the calls the government offered from 13 to 4, and providing the 404B limiting instruction. With all of those safeguards in place, the district court was very clear. This is permissible evidence that is essentially invited by the defendant's testimony.
That well, Ms. Blake, let's say that you've somehow got over the 50-yard line with the 404, and you know the limited review we have of district judges. My focus and my concern is not the admissibility of the 404, because I believe a case can be made for it. My concern is the closing argument. It seems to me you did more than gild the lily. When the prosecutor says, clearly the defendant's drug dealing is not limited to California, it happens here too. Prosecutor says these layers of concealment are used to give drug dealers the plausible deniability, but that doesn't work for the defendant because we already know he's a cocaine dealer. Now, it's one thing to get the 404 in and to use it appropriately, but it seems to me that you've really pushed the edge of the envelope, the government, that is, in the closing argument here. I mean, you just, that linkage is that may be a bridge too far.
And I think that the argument the government was making was really along the lines of what I was speaking about, why the 404B evidence was admissible. It's really, we were trying to say he knew what was in that car and in that trunk because he has a knowledge of cocaine. His whole defense is,
he was a cocaine dealer.
Right. Yeah, you said he was a dealer. He can know what cocaine is, but just knowing what something is doesn't equate, in my mind, to knowing it's inside a particular container.
But his defense...
Aren't those two different things?
They certainly are, but not in this case. The defense was not that I am involved in drug dealing. I am involved only in being a money courier.
He says, I agree there's a container in the trunk. I tend to deal with money. I deal with money. There's the Michigan dealing with money. And he can know down to the most minute detail what cocaine looks like, but whether it's in that trunk or whether it's in the house or whether it's in a third house in the Chicago area or anything, it's just a totally different question.
And the reason I don't think it is, Your Honor, is because of how narrow he prescribed his defense. He was very specific. In answering the questions of the government, he was very specific. I don't know anything about cocaine. I use marijuana. I'm a money courier. And so these calls show and rebut and, in fact, also impeach that testimony.
But why do we link the fact that he actually does know something about cocaine to the fact that in that particular car, in that particular trunk, in that particular container, there happens to be cocaine, not money?
Because
I just don't see the link.
I think it makes his assertion, his defense, implausible.
Because you know he's a drug dealer, as you told the jury.
Not because you know he's a drug dealer, as much as just within days of this conduct,
yeah,
he's talking
what you
about
said.
Drugs.
Judge Flom says that's not what you said to the jury.
We also went through all of the clandestine steps. I mean, I think the knowledge evidence was in aggregate, and because the defense was embracing those pieces of the clandestine steps, it was necessary to go that extra step to rebut this position. I'm a money courier. If I can address briefly the issue of the suppression, this is not a case where there is no other evidence of what was happening.
It's not Williams, though. I mean, there are some significant differences between this case and Williams, because in Williams, the officers were expecting a particular car to arrive at a certain time. They knew that the people who were going to be driving that car had planned to engage in a transaction, and they knew, number three, that the occupants of the house sold drugs. All we have is number three here. We don't have number one. There's no expectation of the car. There's no matchup of the car with the vehicle that actually arrives. It's a substantial stretch beyond Williams.
I think it's different than Williams.
Well, a substantial stretch. So you think you can arrest anybody who leaves a house that's ever been associated with drugs?
That's not the
fact
here.
Pizza delivery man whatever.
But if he had just shown up at the house and we had no other steps, that may be true, but that's not the facts here. He followed the exact same pattern as the prior other targets
and
undercover.
So he drives up to the house and pulls into the driveway?
Well,
why is that a pattern?
He follows a car. A car directs him to where the house is. This is a clandestine operation. They're taking steps. One car drives away. This car comes in. The car backs into the garage. All of these steps, he's only in the garage for moments. These are exactly the same things the undercover had to go through when he
picked
up.
They seem so innocuous to me. You drive behind another car up to a house and you pull in.
It may be innocuous, except for that just 30 minutes prior, an undercover officer picked up 10 kilograms of cocaine. That's what adds that level of suspicion. If police officers were just driving by the house and saw somebody pull in and pull out, they don't know if that person lives there. But they've been surveilling that house. They've watched an undercover officer follow the specific pattern, following a car, backing into a garage, being in the garage for a moment, leaving, and then telling them, I just picked up 10 kilograms of cocaine, and there may be additional drugs in there. And the exact same pattern is followed by the defendant. And in fact, in this case, we saw the pickup truck that led the defendant to the house. First, the pickup truck arrived at the house, spoke to the individual in the house, then left and met with the defendant at a parking lot nearby. And they had 30 seconds where they were sitting next to each other. And then after the truck left, the Lexus followed soon thereafter.
I think this is a huge amount of hindsight. Because I can imagine, you know, in my own neighborhood or anywhere, you know, people stop off at houses, they talk, you know, other people come by. It strikes me that you're arresting a lot of people on the basis of very limited information.
Except for the
risk of false negatives is quite high, if that's all you need to arrest people.
Except for that, just before that same pattern, somebody just picked up 10 kilograms of cocaine. So that was the illegal transaction that led to this. And then on top of it, after they followed him, so even if if there's certainly reasonable suspicion to stop the car, even if there isn't probable cause, well, the government still asserts that there was probable cause. When they stop the car and they interview the two participants,
including
the defendant.
Yeah, I thought that was completely unpersuasive. It seemed to me their stories were quite reconcilable.
Except for they both completely omitted the fact that they just went to this house in Bolingbrook.
It may have seemed so trivial to them that it didn't need saying.
But in aggregate, in the totality of those circumstances, that's where, from the officer's perspective, they had a right to search that car. And if there are no other questions, Your Honors, the government would request that the defendant's conviction be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Brindley?
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the government's arguments about how Mr. Richards responded to the questions about the cocaine from the government, they're using those arguments to try to justify the admission of the 404B evidence. But the only reason he was reacting was because the evidence was admitted. They can't use his reaction to it to justify its admission that already happened. That argument totally fails. The government mentioned a limiting instruction, but during the closing argument, the reason the limiting instruction didn't help is because they were kept making that improper argument that Judge Flom was referencing over and over again all throughout their rebuttal after the instruction was made and the court did nothing, indicating tacit approval, and it was made worse by the fact that the district court said that we couldn't object. When I made an objection at the beginning, he said, I don't want you doing that anymore. And so we were hamstrung, and the jury didn't get to see any opposition to it. I think in regards to the cigarette business issue, the one thing I would like to say about that is if you put that on the drug dealing concept, if you're in the drug dealing business, then 404B is gone forever because everybody who has a prior drug conviction, you can always bring that in under that analogy. Finally, with respect to the issue of the suppression and this pattern they're talking about, they can't only talk about half of the pattern. The real pattern that was followed was they had to actually meet with the guy who was selling it. They knew Juan Regalado. Somebody from his operation had to get in the car, and they had to go with him into the garage. And the truck they're talking about wasn't involved in this. This wasn't a pattern. They had no reason to believe this was going to happen again that they articulated. And as a result of that, I think the evidence should be suppressed. We ask that the court reverse and order suppression or in the alternative, a new trial.
Thank you very much. And, Mr. Brindley, we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.